The current lineup on television is huge, literally. From reality shows to scripted fare, there may be more overweight and obese people on the small screen than ever before. Some critics say television does a lousy job of portraying fat people realistically. As part of our series about obesity called Living Large, Alex Cohen of member station KPCC looks at who is fat on television.
About the only thing all real fat people have in common is that they weigh more. Beyond that, they have incredibly diverse styles, backgrounds, and personalities. But on the small screen, says blogger and fat activist Leslie Kinzel, overweight people often get shrunk into the same stereotypes.
Fat people are lazy. Fat people eat too much. Fat people never, ever exercise. Fat people are filled with self-loathing. And fat people are desperate to be loved.
Oh, no! 239 pounds! I'm a whale!
Exhibit A, Homer Simpson.
Well, from now on, exercise every morning, Homer.
Oh. Don't strain yourself, dear.
Good idea, Marge.
Homer's been downing donuts for more than two decades, but the archetype of the fat, foolish guy dates all the way back to the 1950s with the Honeymooners, says psychotherapist and pop culture analyst Beth Bernstein.
Ralph Kramden really started the formula of the fat, bumbling man with the thin, capable, long-suffering wife that's been repeated from All in the Family to King of Queens and The Simpsons and Family Guy and all those kind of shows.
But at least hefty guys get main roles on TV. Weighty women seldom do. Take it from Kirstie Alley, who played herself 6 years ago on Showtime's Fat Actress, furious that a bigger waistline kept her from bigger parts.
I mean, look, John Goodman's got his own show, and Jason Alexander looks like a frickin' bowling ball. And then how about James Gandolfino? He's like the size of a whale. He's way, way, way fatter than I am.
Like the fat fellas, plus-sized women tend to fall into certain stereotypes, too, says Beth Bernstein. They're usually the fat, funny, best friend.
Never has a boyfriend, is never the focus of a story, but is kind of endearing. And sometimes you have, if it's a woman of color, you have what we kind of call a shorthand is like the sassy black woman.
During the 70s and 80s, says Bernstein, bigger black actresses usually played sassy maternal types, from the moms on What's Happening in Good Times to Nell Carter as the feisty housekeeper on Gimme a Break.
I don't think you're fat, Nell.
Oh, thanks, sweetheart. But if I gain any more weight, I'm going to have to trade in my nightgown for a hefty bag.
In recent years, TV has gotten a bit better, says blogger Leslie Kinzel. At least some of the women now have romantic plot lines, like the lead character who finds love at an Overeaters Anonymous meeting on CBS's Mike and Molly.
It's a show that's trying, I think, to be a little more normalizing of fatness. But at the same time, because it's a sitcom and because it sort of depends on these short, quick jokes that a huge number of people will get, one of the easiest things to joke about is someone being fat.
Hi, my name's Mike. I'm an overeater.
Hi.
I had a pretty fair week. I lost 3 pounds. Then I took off my shirt and I found it right about here.
I don't have a problem with fat jokes that are funny. The problem is that very few of them are.
And, adds Leslie Kinzel, why does weight always have to be treated as a joke? Maybe you've noticed that every TV clip you've heard so far in this story has been from a sitcom? That's no coincidence. Most dramas tend to shy away from the subject, and those that do don't always fare well. Kinzel points to the ABC family drama Huge, about teens at a weight loss camp. It was a huge hit with overweight viewers, but didn't rate as well with the rest of the country. The network canceled it after just 10 episodes. Luckily, says Kinzel, an actress from Huge has come back on one of TV's most popular programs. The character of Lauren Zizes is a snarky wrestler and the newest member of the singing club on Fox's Glee. Viewers were recently shocked when one of the show's hottest hunks tried to woo her with a song and failed.
Let's be honest here. You look the way you look, and I'm embracing that. I mean, it turns me on, babe.
I look like America looks. And like America, I need more than just a song to get my juices flowing.
Actress Ashley Fink plays Lauren Zizes. She thinks Hollywood has gotten better at portraying fat people, but she admits she almost never comes across characters on TV that mirror her real experience as an overweight person.
I dance, I have a great time, I sing, I have great friends. I don't hide in my house because I'm large, you know, and I think that it's unfair that that's not represented on TV.
But Fink adds she finds sitcoms and dramas way more acceptable than reality shows like The Biggest Loser, where contestants are weighed in weekly wearing next to nothing.
Why do they have to be in, you know, sports bras and tiny shorts? It's so people at home can be like, oh, they're so fat, that's so gross. You wouldn't treat animals on television the way they treat some of these people.
Psychotherapist Beth Bernstein likens The Biggest Loser to a tent revival, where contestants repent their former miserable fat lives and only gain redemption once they've lost weight.
I'm tired of being that fat guy. I'm tired of not having a normal life.
Take, for example, a contestant named Don, who initially weighed in at 309 pounds.
And a couple of months ago, my son, who is so distraught over my obesity, he said he don't have anything else to do with me.
Beth Bernstein says TV like that can fuel the terror that people, especially those with eating disorders, have of being fat.
Who wants to be a member of a population where you're mocked and made fun of and criticized and judged?
Former Biggest Loser contestant Danny Cahill sees things differently. He says being a fat guy on TV was the best thing that ever happened to him. He's since become a motivational speaker, and he's resurrected a former career in music.
This is your second chance in life. Don't you wait there for it.
Cahill says his second chance came when he appeared on season 8 of The Biggest Loser and lost more than half his body weight. He says chronicling that experience on national TV sent a tremendously positive message.
And in 11 months, if you can go from 430 pounds to running the Boston Marathon, there's nothing you can't do. And that's what I want people to know, that it's never too late to make a change and change your life.
It's hard to dispute that The Biggest Loser has inspired Americans, says the show's creator, J.D. Roth. People now pay thousands of dollars to go on Biggest Loser weight loss cruises. Each year, the show is inundated with audition videos.
After season one, we were getting 250,000 tapes a year. The U.S. Postal Service quit twice delivering.
Roth is now working on the latest edition of ABC's Extreme Makeover franchise, the weight loss edition. He says as long as there are overweight people in America, you can bet there will be even more of these shows on TV. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen.
It's time for a history lesson. Shall we say a super history lesson? This one from Grant Morrison, one of the world's most revered comic book writers. He's worked for both DC and Marvel Comics, and he's written the words of Superman, Batman, and other heroes. If you're a fan of comic books, well, Grant Morrison is sort of like a god. Exhibit A, the faces of some of my colleagues who are pressed against the glass of the studio right now, waving their arms around. If, like me, you don't spend a whole lot of time paging through comic books, you're about to hear what comic book characters might tell us about everything from American history to cross-dressing. Grant Morrison's new book is Super Gods: What Masked Vigilantes, Miraculous Mutants, and a Sun God from Smallville Can Teach Us About Being Human. Grant Morrison joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
So I guess we all have the image of the comic book, superheroes on the page and the bubble quotes. You were a kid growing up in Scotland. What brought you into this world?
It was kind of weird. I mean, I guess what really got me into it was my mother was a big fan of science fiction. And her father had been a fan of science fiction, and that was quite unusual for working class people in Scotland and, you know, pre-war. But certainly, my parents were anti-nuclear activists, so the big fear in my house was the bomb. And as a kid, I was terrified of the bomb, you know, it was just this thing that would kill us all. And then I discovered Superman. And those comic books had characters who could laugh at the bomb. You know, Superman could take the atom bomb in his face and shake it off and only get a tan. So I kind of really attached myself to those guys because they helped me make a lot of sense out of that.
Why wouldn't a working class family in Scotland be into science fiction?
It just wasn't done. It was seen as frivolous, you know, particularly in Scotland, which is very down to earth, very grounded, and people didn't like the fanciful. They liked crazy humour, but if you were into, say, American superheroes, it was seen as slightly suspect, you know, the idea that you would take any of this ridiculous nonsense seriously.
Yeah. You wrote that the first glimpse of Superman was really deliberately ambiguous, not necessarily flying. Describe for us that very first issue of Action Comics where we first meet Superman.
Well, the first image of Superman appears without any copy at all. You know, the comic was Action Comics. It was number one. No one had ever seen this thing before. And on the front, there's a guy dressed in a cape and tights smashing a car off a rock while three other men run in every possible direction to get away from him. And so that very first appearance of Superman, we've no idea if he's a hero at all, if he's on our side. I mean,
we don't know whether to fear him, to like him, to
exactly,
what he's up to.
Exactly, you know, and he's destroying a car, which at the time was kind of a symbol of America's technological superiority. You know, normally we would have seen those cars rolling off the production belts at Ford. Instead, here was a man actually picking one up and destroying it quite flamboyantly.
Well, after we see the success of Superman, a lot of comic book writers wanted to jump in and try to recreate that. And you write that the answer was Batman.
Yeah.
And in some ways it was almost reversing the polarity. What defined this character and made him different from Superman?
I think a lot of it was very calculated. You know, as I said in the book, Batman is so much an obvious opposite of Superman that it's quite clear that somebody just sat down and broke it all down and put it back together again.
In the opposite way?
Pretty much, you know, and Superman's a solar hero. He gets his power from the sun. So Batman hangs out at night. You know, Superman works alone and he has no partners. Batman has a boy partner.
You say that Batman was like the Rolling Stones to Superman's Beatles.
Yeah, because Batman was cool. You know, Superman had a boss and he worked in a job and the girl across in the other side of the office didn't like him. Batman has a butler. He sleeps in all day. You know, he's surrounded by all these girls in leather who are constantly chasing him and trying to get off with him and or kill him. So it's kind of, as I said in the book, it's the capitalist superhero versus the socialist superhero. It's the socialist versus the socialite.
Right.
And I think it's why Batman's been more popular recently, because in our culture, it's, you know, it's much more aspirational to be a billionaire success than it is to be a farm worker or a newspaper reporter. So we've kind of become the sort of people who would rather have Batman or Iron Man.
I'm speaking with comic book writer Grant Morrison in his new book, Super Gods, is in bookstores right now. Grant, can we talk about cross-dressing?
Sure, we can. soon as possible.
Of course. Jimmy Olsen worked for the Daily Planet alongside Clark Kent, alongside Superman, and he starts dressing like a woman, Jimmy Olsen
yeah,
does.
What was that
about?
I have no idea. Again, it was those stories in the 50s where instead of trying to deal with the real world, which, you know, Superman had started out doing in the Depression, it was very real. It was real gangsters, real politicians. But in the 50s, it just went insane. So Jimmy would be dressed as a girl and then he'd be forced to, you know, have a date with an ape. And the piling up of madness and surrealism would just get more and more grotesque until somehow Superman would come along at the end and with some very easy explanation, it would all go back to normality.
Well, you yourself decided to cross-dress for a while, and you say it sort of shaped your writing in many ways. What was going on?
I'd reached 30, and I'd had a fairly cloistered life. You know, I'd grown up wanting to write, and I'd went to a boys' school, so I kind of spent most of my teenage years just learning to write and being indoors, you know, a proper kind of geek existence.
Cooped up.
Yeah, so although I'd, you know, in my 20s I was in a band and lots of other things had happened, I was with a very nice girl, I felt as if I hadn't done a lot of things, so I went a bit nutty at 30 and decided to do a lot of the stuff that I hadn't ever tried, like drinking and
cross-dressing,
for instance. But I was doing a comic called The Invisibles, and one of the characters one of the characters was a cross-dressing transvestite shaman from Brazil. So I thought, well, I'm going to learn what it's like to be a transvestite shaman.
And what's the lesson for aspiring writers? I mean, if you want to write about a transvestite witch, do you, as a writer, need to become one?
I think all writers should do that. I think if Stephen King wants to write his next book about a transvestite witch, he really needs to wear a dress.
I have to say, when I first heard that we were doing this interview, I'm not a comic book guy, and I was kind of like, you know, the old dusty comic books people collected. What's going to be fresh about that? You've taught me a lot. But for those of us who are not in the comic book world, give us the argument for why we should give comics a chance, why I should go out today and buy some comic books and get to reading.
Well, the easy argument is that they are as good as anything else you might look at. In fact, they're better than most things. You know, good comic books are as good as your favourite movie, as good as your favourite record, as good as your favourite TV show, and are well worth being on the pop culture diet of any smart, you know, adult who's living in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
They have their very specific way of dealing with the world. You know, other things like movies and TV shows take years to make. A comic is on the streets within 3 months of it being created. There's very little editorial influence, so you're seeing artists work directly on the page. So I think the real value of comic book stories and of the movie stories and of everything that we've talked about superheroes over the last 70 years is actually to provide role models for a new generation that will be so far beyond as we've only considered it in these ridiculous stories. And the fact that at least there was an outlet for this is we've kind of tested the idea to destruction. So when new superheroes appear on the planet, real superheroes, they'll have all this material to study and kind of figure out what are we supposed to be and do.
And real superheroes will be arriving soon?
They're here already. I mean, there's people on the streets wearing costumes fighting crime right now, and they're fighting crime without superpowers. But, you know, give those guys bionic legs, give them like X-ray eyes, and wait to see what happens
next.
That
really kicks some butt.
Yeah.
Well, Grant Morrison tells us we should all go while away an afternoon reading a comic book. If you want to while away an afternoon, you can also read his new book, Super Gods, What Masked Vigilantes, Miraculous Mutants, and a Sun God from Smallville Can Teach Us About Being Human, and it's out in bookstores now. Grant Morrison, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much. That was great.
Marvel just shook up the pages of the comic book world in its Ultimate Comics Spider-Man series. Peter Parker, Spidey's alter ego, has died. Taking his place is Miles Morales, a multiracial teen of Black and Hispanic descent. Turns out that comics have long been more open to racially diverse characters than some other forms of art, which got screenwriter and Morning Edition commentator John Ridley thinking about diversity in Hollywood.
The big-budget disappointment Green Lantern was about a superhero whose powers are only limited by his imagination. I kind of get the feeling Hollywood's earning powers are being limited by their lack of imagination. Consider the box office potential if movie producers had been as bold as the Marvel Universe with their new Spider-Man and had reimagined Green Lantern as a person of color. It actually wouldn't have been that much of a stretch. In the comic book world, there's already a Black Green Lantern named Jon Stewart, who's probably got more name recognition going for him than his white counterpart, Hal Jordan. If Hollywood can crank out fantasy pictures with blue Smurfs, why is it so reticent to do the same with Blacks, Hispanics, and Asians? If second stringers like Thor can get the big screen treatment, don't comic book legends of color like Luke Cage and the Black Panther deserve the same? Every hero needs a villain, and I can tell you from experience that supposedly liberal Hollywood loves to make the audience the bad guy. There's a self-fulfilling delusion at work in the studio system that white audiences won't pay to see Black actors cast outside a narrow type of role. In his concisely titled study, The Role of Actors' Race in White Audiences' Selective Exposure to Movies, Indiana University professor Andrew Weaver writes that, quote, movie producers are often reluctant to cast more than a few minority actors in otherwise race-neutral movies for fear that the white audiences will largely avoid such films, end quote. But Weaver found that white audiences tended to be racially selective with regard to romantic movies and not particularly so with other genres. So, sorry, Hollywood, you can't blame it on the ticket buyers. And as comic book movies as bankable franchises begin to cool, I mean, did we really need 4 Hero in Tights movies this summer alone? You gotta wonder, will studios get hip to going after multicultural audiences? Casting Academy Award nominee Lawrence Fishburne as Daily Planet editor Perry White in the upcoming Superman movie is a good, if tentative, step in the right, non-traditional casting direction. But for a real leap, how about Will Smith as Superman? I guarantee you, non-stop chatter until the film opens. And Denzel as Superman's father, Jor-El, Michelle Rodriguez as Lois Lane. Clearly, the folks at Marvel Comics are open to the possibilities. Now, if we could only get Hollywood to make their fantasy pictures look a little more fantastic than your average gated community.
Screenwriter John Ridley, whose superhero alter ego is known as Commentator John Ridley. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. We end today's program with ink. We're flipping through the pages of comic books. In a moment, we speak with one of the creators of the new biracial Spider-Man. He's half African-American and half Latino. That's in a few minutes. But first, we take a look at an exhibition that chronicles 4 decades of Asian images in American comic books, some extremely stereotypical. Consider the nefarious Yellowclaw from a 1956 Marvel comic book, who looked like an evil vampire of sorts with garish yellow skin, long claw-like fingernails, and exaggerated, almost animal-like features. The exhibit, called Marvels and Monsters, Unmasking Asian Images in U.S. Comics, looks at how images of Asians that began as xenophobic propaganda have evolved and how such characters still define some American perceptions of Asians today. It's on display at the New York University Library through August 19th. Joining us now to talk about it are science fiction writer William F. Wu, whose collection of comics is featured in the exhibit. We also have with us exhibit curator Jeff Yang. He's one of the editors of the book Secret Identities, the Asian American Superhero Anthology. His column, Asian Pop, appears in the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to the program, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Wu, talk to us a bit about your collection and how you started thinking about the way Asians were characterized in the books.
I had always loved comic books. You know, I started reading them when I was little, and as I got older and more interested in popular culture representations of Asian Americans, I found I already had a lot of them in my comics, and I started separating out the comics that had Asian characters.
When did you start thinking, the people on those pages don't look like anyone I know?
I suppose it was subliminal, you know, from the very beginning. I was thinking just before we started that I had noticed an old Lone Ranger comic book in which the Lone Ranger was a hero who had black hair. It was one of the few, along with Superman. And this showed up in a play called Chicken Coop Chinaman by Frank Chin, where the main character fantasizes that the Lone Ranger is really Asian and he wears the mask to hide his Asian eyes. And I think I was having this kind of reaction as I was growing up, but it was really not until my 20s that I began thinking about these things in a systematic way.
Jeff, I want to ask you the same question. When you're a comic book fan as well. Uh-huh. What was your first favorite character?
It's funny because I think that for me, it wasn't a single character so much as kind of the larger idea of comic book superheroes. Mm-hmm. The idea that superheroes represented individuals who were extraordinary but had to hide that extraordinary aspect of themselves, had to sort of, you know, put on masks to protect the things that made them different, both for good and for evil. And that notion that somehow, especially those for whom their powers also made them kind of outcasts, outsiders, was something that I think was appealing not just to myself as an Asian American comic book fan, but to comic book fans across the board, and I think especially comic book fans of color. It's part of the reason why I think you're seeing that generation of fans growing up into creators and now I think increasingly taking dominant roles in the industry.
Jeff, the exhibition kind of looks at the way comic books and current events mesh together. Over time, how has American history influenced the way Asians are depicted?
One of the things that we realized as we looked at this collection, and the collection is extraordinary. He has collected literally hundreds, thousands of comic books across a span that in many ways defines the forge of Asian America in a way, 1941 all the way through 1986, a period of time in which America was engaged in physical wars and sort of spiritual ones with Asian countries, you know, from World War II, mm-hmm. The war in the Pacific, through the Korean War, Vietnam War, and then the economic and political battles with Japan and China that followed. And so comic books in a lot of ways pick up a lot of this resonant energy around how Americans were thinking of Asians in ways that virtually no other medium does. You see this character, like the character of the Yellow Claw, emerging, this sort of monstrous, incredibly alien, exotic figure, this puppet master behind the scenes, emerging just as America's anxiety around Chinese immigration, around the changing demographics of the country, was first beginning to be felt.
Yeah, this is Bill. I'd like to mention that Yellow Claw was also an imitation Fu Manchu, kind of a joining, I think, of the older stereotypes, the danger of the yellow peril, envisioned the way it was envisioned in the 19th century, coming into the 20th, and then, of course, merging with the elements that Jeff was talking about, the wars, fears of immigration. It all kind of entwines together.
If you're just tuning in, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes, and we're talking about Marvels and Monsters, a new exhibition on Asians and Asian Americans in comic books. Our guest, our science fiction writer, William F. Wu. His collection is the primary source of material for the exhibit, and we're also joined by curator Jeff Yang. Jeff, I want to ask you, who are some of the current Asian characters in comics? There's an X-Man, or I should say X-Woman, right?
The X-Men you're referring to is Jubilee, of course. Jubilee being a Chinese-American kind of mall rat girl who discovers her mutant ability to basically shoot fireworks out of her hands.
Which is pretty cool, you must admit.
Well, it's cool, but it is sort of funny how if you're a superhero of a particular race or color, your ethnicity always shapes your power somehow. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there are characters like Jubilee. There are characters like Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu. Actually, a lot of characters who also embody this archetype of the martial artist or the sort of wise occult guru and so forth. Not as many iconic characters on the level of, say, a Superman or Batman or Wonder Woman, though.
William, I wonder if you think Americans still see Asians, as Jeff was just saying, exotic people with powers that are based on your ethnicity, you know, people that are magical and able to manipulate your minds, or has that evolved over the course of, you know, the years you've been collecting and through now?
I suppose there is an evolution. I try to be optimistic about these things, and I believe there is long-term improvement. But popular culture is extremely important with these matters because, by definition, it reaches almost everybody. One of the things we often see are kind of the ongoing throwbacks. I noticed recently in the entertainment news that a screenplay has been turned in for the Marvel character Doctor Strange. But Doctor Strange is a white man who is schooled by the Ancient One, and he has a young assistant named Wong. You know, it begs the question of, what's the white guy doing here? Why not have the Asian guru teach the Asian assistant to become the magician?
Jeff, I want to ask you in the few minutes we have left, the exhibit ends in the late 80s, but that's kind of just before Asian Americans started flooding the comic book industry. And there's anime out there now. And having just talked about the Doctor Strange movie, how has the characterization of Asians and Asian Americans changed on the pages of comic books?
I think you've seen a real revolution in the way that Asians are depicted in a general sense, both in terms of inclusion and, generally speaking, cultural sensitivity or authenticity, driven more than anything else by the fact that there are so many Asian American creators. And at this point, actually, Asian Americans at the very highest decision-making levels of the comics industry. Jim Lee, for instance, is the co-publisher of DC and as a result has unprecedented ability to reshape the iconography that all of us have grown up with. I mean, as usual, because he's a fan, he's very respectful of that. But, you know, you're seeing, without question, new stories being created, new characters that are emerging, I think in many ways reflecting a more true sense of what America looks like and the world looks like.
We've got to leave it there. Jeff Yang is curator for the exhibition Marvels and Monsters, Unmasking Asian Images in U.S. Comics. He also writes the Asian Pop column for the San Francisco Chronicle. He joined us from our bureau in New York. And William F. Wu collected the artwork that's on display. He's also an award-winning science fiction author. He was kind enough to join us from member station KCSN in Northridge, California. Thank you, gentlemen, both.
Thank you very much.